From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. The internet is an American invention. You may have heard a few Al Gore jokes about that. But according to a new survey, people in at least 14 other countries enjoy better, faster access to the internet than Americans do. Policymakers at every level of government are coming up with plans to close that gap. Plans for citywide wireless networks, plans to encourage competition in the private sector, even plans to give away broadband for free. But are we making any progress in the global broadband race? And how much will America's broadband infrastructure affect its economic success in the 21st century? Joining us to have this Tech Tuesday conversation is Gigi Sohn, president and founder of Public Knowledge. That's a Washington-based advocacy group dedicated to promoting the public interest and access to information. Gigi, good to see you again.
Great to see you, Kojo.
Also with us is Robert Atkinson, president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. That's a Washington-based think tank that studies public policies related to technological innovation in the U.S. and abroad. Robert Atkinson, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Kojo.
Also with us is Scott Walston, vice president for research and senior fellow at the Technology Policy Institute and senior fellow at the Georgetown Center for Business and Public Policy. Scott, glad you could join us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to
be here.
Course,
you know how to join a Tech Tuesday conversation. You call us 800-433-8850. We like to consider ourselves top dog in America, but according to a new report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, 14 countries are ahead of the U.S. on the high-speed internet front. What does this ranking mean, and should we be using it to measure our progress in making broadband available in the United States? First, you, Scott.
Well, thanks for the question. The OECD broadband rankings actually don't mean very much, and the reason is because of what they are able to measure. They're essentially in the U.S. not able to measure business connections. Neither can the FCC, actually. And they're probably missing, according to the census and Nielsen ratings, about 70 million workplace broadband connections. And our declining rank in the OECD numbers is actually just a statistical anomaly having to do with the fact that we have larger household sizes. And that's why Japan's rank is falling as well, and Korea's rank is falling. As long as our household size is larger, we will have fewer residential connections per capita. Then that's just a statistical phenomenon, then there's really nothing we can do to that, about that aside, short of having smaller households.
Just a statistical glitch here, Gigi Sohn, or are we in fact falling behind?
Well, I think we could have a very interesting academic conversation about why the OECD rankings are not important. You know, we can talk about whether the U.S. is more rural or more urban than some of the others, and we could talk about whether Wi-Fi and Starbucks should count, but I think that's irrelevant. What's relevant is that when you compare us to many other countries, our broadband is slow, it's expensive, and that there is almost no competition for broadband service here in the U.S. 96% of households in this country have a choice of either cable or telephone. So I think getting down to the weeds of why we're ranked 15th as opposed to 14th as opposed to 10th is less important than the fact that relative to many other countries, we are way, way behind.
Robert Atkinson.
Well, let me take a middle ground, I guess. I think the OECD numbers tell us a lot. In 2000, we were ranked fourth, and we've gone down on a pretty steady basis since then. We were 15th last year, we're 15th this year. Scott makes a good point about households. If a report that we did at ITIF, if you include households, if you make control for household size, we go up to 12th. You can't dismiss the rankings, I would argue. On the other hand, I don't think it's as bleak, maybe, as Gigi says. We do have pretty robust intermodal competition. One of the A lot of people look at, and what that means is between modes, between cable and telephone or in DSL. A lot of people look at Europe and say, oh, Europe's got all this robust competition. One of the reasons Europe has competition intramodal, in other words, over the telephone line, is because they have messed up their cable regulations. Many countries let the cable companies be owned by the telephone companies, and they didn't deploy broadband, obviously. We didn't make that mistake, and so we do have a lot of cable broadband that's getting faster and a lot of telephone or DSL or fiber broadband that's getting faster. It's not quite as bad, I think, as some people would say. Not as good either.
Gigi, what is the best way we should be comparing countries on the broadband front?
Well, I think the way the OECD does it is pretty good. I mean, they look at the number of subscribers per 100 people in a country, and we have 23%, I think, as we have 23 out of 100 of our individuals in this country have subscribed to broadband. So I'm not sure that methodology is necessarily bad. I did want to make another point following up on what Rob and Scott said, is we also have to think about in this country there are 10 million households that don't have broadband at all, and that there are 50 million households that can get broadband but choose not to. And that, again, is a function, I believe, of the lack of competition, because competition drives down prices and drives up speeds.
Well, let me compare that statistic with the one that the Federal Communications Commission puts out, and that is, it says that broadband is available in 99% of the zip codes in the United States. What should I make of that?
Well, you shouldn't make very much of it, and that's why the FCC has just changed that policy, because what the FCC used to do, or I guess they still do it, they still haven't come out with the actual order with the new regulations, but what the FCC does is say, if Kojo, you and I both live in 2008, and you have broadband, that means I have broadband, even if
you have access.
I don't. Right.
It's available.
Right.
Scott, President Bush threw down the gauntlet a few years ago and said he wanted universal broadband access in the U.S. by 2007. We just heard some statistics from Gigi and what the FCC is saying. How close have we really come to that goal? And, well, I guess we have some sense of that, but what do we have to do now to follow through?
Well, first, I'd say that I think universal coverage is really important if we're talking about healthcare. I'm not so sure that that's true with broadband, but I also want to come back to what Rob and Gigi said about the data. First, Gigi said we can have an argument about the details, about the weeds, and I think we do need to have that discussion, because once we turn to talking about policy, we need to have a good sense of what's going to make a difference. Now, with the OECD numbers, you can't simply divide those numbers by households to get a household penetration rate, because in some countries they include lots of business connections and in other countries they don't. I have a new paper on this. And when you look at household surveys, we find that about, the U.S. Census shows that about 50% of all U.S. households now subscribe to broadband. And this, when you compare it to other household surveys, ones that do not include wireless, we tend to be around ninth. And my point isn't at all to say that the U.S. is doing great or that the U.S. is number one, but that we want to take a very close look at what the data tell us so that when we make policy decisions, we make sure that we do something that's cost-effective and that actually makes a difference.
I guess what people would want to know fundamentally is, should we be doing better?
I think that's a very hard question to answer, because if it implies that that somehow right now there isn't enough investment, say, and then we want to know what is the right investment, where are we lagging, and there's a lot of focus, for example, right now on rural areas, but as you pointed out, there's actually very high availability, especially if you include wireless and satellite, although those certainly don't have the bandwidth or latency that wired connections do. But if you look at the data, especially from the U.S. Census, which surveyed the population in October 2007, you see a much bigger gap at lower income levels. But policies so far tend to focus on rural areas, not on low-income people.
So we have both rural areas and the digital divide. And I guess this is the point at which people say, look, why shouldn't the government be taking the lead? Some states have taken the lead and adopted their own broadband policies. Some are pushing for a national broadband policy. What do you think a sound national broadband policy should look like, if we need one at all, starting with you, Gigi?
Well, we certainly need a broadband policy, and I think that's one of the failings here, is that this administration has paid absolutely no attention to broadband policy, and I think it's been to our detriment. So you need investment. I agree with Scott on that. But you also need policies that promote competition. And you will hear from me many, many times today getting back to the competition point because I think it's crucial. Okay? A number of years ago, we had policies that allowed 6,000 Internet service providers to flourish. Now there's only those, you know, those regulations have been repealed, and now we just have a couple hundred. So I do think, I'm usually not a fan of going back to the past, but I actually think we do have to go back to the past a little bit. We have to look at line sharing, where competitors used to be able to use incumbents, get access to incumbents' lines and incumbent services. I think we need to look at wholesale access, where incumbent providers provide a line at a wholesale rates to competitors. We need to completely rethink our spectrum policy in this country. The U.S. just had a big spectrum auction where the vast majority of the spectrum went to Verizon and AT&T, the two largest wireless providers, the two largest telephone companies. And as I'm sure many of your listeners know, Verizon is about to get bigger. So competition policy has not been very robust in this administration, and it really needs to change.
Well, according to Judy, we don't have a whole lot to do. We just have a great deal of a whole lot to do. You can join us at 800-433-8850. What do you think the federal government should be doing to make broadband more available in the United States? Robert Atkinson.
Well, I think a couple of points need to be made. One is we don't really have a significant broadband availability problem, particularly in suburban and urban areas. California Task Force just found less than 1% of residents in the San Francisco Bay Area cannot get broadband, and those are mostly in the exurban areas of the Bay Area. We did a little study here in D.C. We found that in the poorest census tracts in D.C. and Baltimore, we found that every household could get broadband. Now, they don't get it. Now, many don't get it. And the big challenge here is if we had the same level of computer ownership at home that we do, that some of the leading countries had, we would be in the top five in international broadband. The reason we're not in the top five is because many people in the U.S. just simply don't have computers, aren't comfortable with them, don't know how to use them. So we've got a big, I think the next challenge for the next administration, their big challenge here, is to look at the demand side. How do we make sure that people can get access to these technologies? I just want to make a point on competition. I think competition is completely overblown as a solution here. There's no evidence that there isn't robust price competition here in the U.S. What we're dealing with in some ways are natural monopolies or natural duopolies. There's no evidence that there's excess profits in the industry. So more competition would get you what? You only want competition if there's monopoly profits in an industry. We don't really want to have multiple lines. One of the things, by the way, in the U.S. that I would argue the administration has gotten right is this notion of letting companies invest in next-generation networks and not have to unbundle them. That's one of the reasons why we're seeing big fiber builds out, where we're seeing the next generation of cable build out in very high-speed cables, because they can get the rewards from that.
Scott Walson, either we have a digital divide because there are a number of people who cannot afford to have computers or laptops in their homes, or people have made a choice not to have computers or laptops in their home. Which is it?
Well, according to a recent survey, people who choose not to have internet, about 44% of those just decided that there was nothing. They said that there was nothing on the internet that interested them. Now, of course, you have to modify that. That's of course with what they know is available and at current prices. But it was a very small percentage that it wasn't available. But there were some people who said access was too expensive, or they didn't have a computer and that was too expensive. And I believe that policies can rightly focus on that group. But I want to come back to the competition point and to kind of, sort of agree and disagree with both Gigi and Rob. Competition, I believe, is hugely important. I don't believe telecommunications is a natural monopoly anymore. I don't actually believe it ever was. And the research on this is quite solid. However, the competition that Gigi refers to in Europe is, as Rob said, intra-platform. So in France, we hear great things about broadband in France. They're all providing it over France Telecom's lines for the most part. And this was part of something that was called in Europe the ladder of investment.
Which is one of the things Gigi seems to feel we should get back to here.
Absolutely. I need to just
we'll
talk
come back
about
to you in a second, Scott.
The difference between broadband availability. Broadband is widely available in this country. Nobody will dispute that. But as I said before, 50 million households choose not to subscribe. Why? In most of the research I've seen, it's because the price is too high. So I find it unbelievable to hear that competition can't help. Any economist would say competition drives down prices and improves service. And I think that's what we saw years ago in the narrowband ISP market, and it would be nice to have here in the broadband market.
I guess well,
they're cutting the price of the iPhone in half, which has got me upset already because I paid. Anyway, go
I'm
ahead.
Not upset. I don't have one.
Let's not go there.
We have a disagreement over how we define competition. And Rob and I are defining it as competition across platforms, so cable and DSL. Gigi is defining it as on one platform. And there's been a lot of there's lots and lots of economic research, empirical research that shows the effects of platform competition rather than intra-platform competition. And we're beginning to see the problems of this intra-platform competition in Europe now. They're having a lot of trouble figuring out how to pay to roll out fiber. France now, they've been saying these companies that use France Telecom service to offer DSL it fairly cheaply, apparently. They've been saying now since 2006 that they're rolling out fiber, and yet there's almost zero fiber to the home in France.
And lack of incentive?
That's right, because companies have no incentive or have less incentive to roll it out because they're going to have to share it.
We're going to have to take a short break, and we're getting a lot of telephone calls, so if the lines are busy, you can send us an email to Kojo, K-O-J-O, at WAMU.org for this Tech Tuesday conversation on broadband. I'm Kojo Nandi. My producers and I are dedicated to connecting our neighborhoods with the world. By using email and call-ins, we've always set a place at the table for our listeners. Now, WAMU 88.5 is moving our conversations forward at conversation.wamu.org. Our new social network lets you suggest story ideas for the Kojo Nandi Show and engage in provocative discussions with other public radio listeners. More information is at conversation.wamu.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's Tell Me More.
Do you cry every time you pull up to a gas station and see $4 a gallon on the pump? Well, your friends in Norway are paying close to $10.
People realize that the gasoline tax has good purposes.
But don't dry those tears yet. In Venezuela, the price is less than 10 cents.
We are more wasteful than you are because we have the cheap gas.
I'm Michelle Martin, live in the two countries with the world's highest and lowest gas prices. Next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From the Association of American Railroads, today's freight railroads are committed to working hard for the environment by moving a ton of freight 436 miles on just 1 gallon of fuel. More online at freightrailworks.org.
It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking about broadband and what needs to be done in the United States with Scott Walston, Vice President for Research and Senior Fellow at the Technology Policy Institute, Senior Fellow at the Georgetown Center for Business and Public Policy. Gigi Sohn is president and founder of Public Knowledge, which is a Washington-based advocacy group dedicated to promoting the public interest in access to information. And Robert Atkinson is president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. That's a Washington-based think tank. It studies public policies related to technological information in the U.S. and abroad. We now go directly to the telephone. Here is Linda in Loudoun County, Virginia. Linda, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. I live in Loudoun County, Virginia, and also in Grand County, Colorado. And in both places, my only option is a satellite. And in both places, the satellite speeds, you know, really could not be called broadband. I mean, it is barely faster than dial-up, and yet I pay almost $100 a month. I know the Verizon card is supposed to work. I recently bought one of those. That's not working very well either. Is there any hope for us who live in rural America? And I'm going to hang up and take your answer on the air.
What would be the hope for people in rural America, Scott Walston?
I think the the improvements in wireless broadband are definitely going to help. Satellite wasn't an option a few years ago, and the Verizon AirCard wasn't an option a few years ago. That sounds like for Linda, it may still not be an option. There are already several programs that try to promote broadband in rural America, such as the Rural Utility Service, which I think they say they've spent around $6 billion on it, but there hasn't been any evaluation of whether this is effective. West Virginia now has a new law that sounds really innovative. If a company identifies an area that doesn't have service, it can apply to the state for a grant, and then the state opens it up to competitive bidding for other providers. So it seems like a nice way to identify areas without service, and then to implement what economists might call a reverse auction to see what sort of subsidies might actually be needed, rather than just relying on what a company says.
Gigi Sohn, should this be an issue in the presidential campaign that we're looking at now? And if it should be an issue in this presidential campaign, how do you think it should be dealt with?
Well, I think broadband penetration, broadband availability, particularly in rural areas, must be an issue in this campaign.
Especially given the healthcare concerns.
Well, it's healthcare, it's education, it's participation in the economy, it's the ability to speak and participate in our culture. I mean, broadband really affects everything, and you cannot do many of these things with a dial-up. I think the answer to the caller's problem is much more difficult. It's comprehensive reform of the Universal Service Fund, which is a huge morass, which is not really enriching rural areas like it should. I mean, right now, Universal Service Funds, which is one of the taxes that you pay on your landline telephone bill, does not go to broadband. It goes to a little bit of broadband, so DSL, but it doesn't go to fiber to the home or cable modem service. So, you know, people in rural areas are really out of luck when it comes to this Universal Service Fund. And at the minimum, at a bare minimum, Universal Service Fund has to be applied to broadband services in rural areas.
Rob, I know that you feel there is a pressing need for a national policy, but what should it be?
Well, we need a national policy that's both on the demand side and the supply side. On the supply side, to give you an example, a report we just issued on explaining international broadband leadership. If you look at a country like Sweden, very rural, lots of northern communities up there. If we had invested as a government what they invested as a government, we would have had to invest over $35 billion in rural broadband. So they've spent a lot of money. They've gotten fiber to these communities. We've maybe invested a few $100 million over that period of time. So Gigi's right. We need to invest more in rural broadband. We need to do more things around spectrum. We need to do a whole set of things. But we also need to focus on the demand side. And I keep coming back to that because mm-hmm. that's really an important issue. And it's partly about partly about affordability, but it's also about digital literacy. And it's about how do you help people understand these technologies and become comfortable with them.
Are there any states that you can point to that you feel are doing this well?
There are some states that are doing it well in rural areas. So, for example, there's a model program called Connect Kentucky, which is focused on rural areas on both the supply and the demand side. One of the innovative programs that they have is they've put together these community leadership teams. They'll go into a community where there's not very much broadband, there's not a lot of usage of it, and they'll get leaders to explain how to use it, develop training programs with the local schools, the community colleges, and the like. So there are some good examples around the country that Mayor Daley's Digital Divide Task Force in Chicago has been doing very good work. We need to build on those, and we need federal leadership and federal support to help them.
Allow me to get back. Oh, you wanted to say something, Scott?
One other thing. I mean, again, we're focusing on rural broadband, and if you look at the census data broken down by state, I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn which state has the second highest household broadband penetration rate. The first is New Hampshire, for reasons I don't know, but the second is Alaska. Alaska has the second highest broadband penetration rate in the country, famously rural Alaska. And of course, that's because its income is about average median income in Alaska is about $10,000 higher than the rest of the country. So again, I would come back to policies probably that focus more on income rather than just rural, which is the Universal Service Fund tends to focus on rural and enriches rural telephone companies. Research shows that it hasn't really done much other than that.
Before we get to the telephones.
Cold in Alaska.
No, it's also because Senator Ted Stevens is the ranking member of the Senate Commerce
Excellent
Committee.
Excellent point. Absolutely.
Indeed. We're going to get to the telephones in a second, but there's one thing I need to clear up because, Rob, you mentioned the point about digital literacy, and I'm beginning to wonder, at what point does digital literacy become a necessity if we're in fact going to be using broadband more and more, if in fact it's going to be more and more effective in dealing with education and with healthcare and the like? At what point does digital illiteracy no longer serve as an excuse for not providing broadband to a home?
3 or 4 years ago. We crossed that point. We wrote a report back in late 1990s and said it wasn't that much of an issue then because only 5-10% of people had broadband. It is an issue now. And as DG rightly points out, there are more and more things that are going online, government services, the ability to find information about environmental quality conditions, all of these things. And if you can't use these technologies, you are going to be left behind and will be left behind.
Here's Marvin in Alexandria, Virginia. Marvin, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi, Kojo. I hear your tech types there talking about broadband. My experience with my ISP and the gateway, I find out that, as far as I can tell, I pop the built-in XP or Vista module, and if you do Control-Alt-Delete, you can pop up a window that tells you your actual throughput for networking. My experience has been that the ISP gateway computer has been programmed to decrease my throughput after the first 5 or 10 seconds, and so you might go broadband, but you're really not getting the throughput you need.
Anyone care to comment on that?
Sure.
It's Scott Walston, Marvin.
Marvin makes a great point that people can actually test their own speeds to see what speeds they're getting. One site they can go to is speedtest.net. Which will allow them to test their speeds using a server that's relatively close to them. And they also have global statistics, so you can see what sorts of speeds countries around the world actually have as opposed to what's advertised. I don't know what's happening with his computer, of course, but I think looking at actual speeds is an excellent thing to do.
Marvin, thank you very much for your call. Here we go now to Don in Sterling, Virginia. Don, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you for my call. I've been a business traveler across Europe for many years, and it's been mostly difficult to find any kind of internet access, dial-up or otherwise, at a business traveler type of look, like hotels or restaurants. You have to go to an internet cafe to get anything like that, and if there was that wide of distribution, I would think that it would be much more available and much less expensive for the business traveler, in my experience. You know, I've had numbers of expenses where they questioned my internet access, and I said, no, you have to pay for it overseas. And I'll take the response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. Robert? Rob?
You know, I think one of the things that the U.S. is very good at is business use of broadband, business use of IT. We're actually the world leader in that. There's a lot of studies on that that show that we do it better. It's been a big part of our economy. So in some ways, the European business sector, the European economy is lagging behind. But what most of these studies are talking about and what we're talking about today is residential broadband, which is a little different.
Back to the telephones. Here now is Edward in Winchester, Virginia. Edward, your turn.
Yes, hello. I just went through this whole thing about broadband access. I was living in rural Millwood, Virginia, and it's about 45 miles outside of D.C., where I had DSL, and I was able to finagle that for my location, but nobody in the whole area, which is, you know, way up there on the per capita income range, and a lot of high-tech, you know, people that are out there. I moved 8 miles from there, and trying to get DSL, there's absolutely no DSL where I moved to, you know, and the only options I have for broadband is either satellite, which the other woman referred to, which is $100 a month, and I know other people, film producers, that's constantly going down on them. So I had to get a satellite, had to get a wireless card to use in my computer. That cost me $60 a month, you know, and it's just, to me, and that does not give me another phone line. With DSL, will give me a phone line plus the broadband line. I mean, it's outrageously expensive, and it's outrageously difficult to get a hold of. I'm in rural Virginia. I'm in Millwood. I'm 45 miles outside of D.C. You know, to me, it's ridiculous. Thank you. I'll take any comments off here.
Gigi Song?
Well, the caller makes a point that I'd wanted to make before, and that is looking at mobile broadband, like the EVDO card that Sprint and Verizon has, as some sort of competition. For example, I mean, the speeds are impossibly slow and the prices are impossibly high, as the caller just mentioned. So, for example, an EVDO card gets speeds of 600 kilobits per second to 1.4 megabits per second. It's $80 a month. AT&T's mobile wireless is 400 to 700 kilobits per second for $60 a month, and you also have to get the wireless phone service along with it. So, you know, the notion that mobile wireless is at any time going to be a real competitor to cable modem service or DSL service, it's really a long way off.
Countries like Japan and South Korea, according to the OECD numbers that we mentioned earlier, Rob, have pretty extensive broadband infrastructures. How did they get to that point?
If you go to Japan, there's over 75% of households have fiber optic cable right to the home. And it's the fastest growing adoption in Japan. People are switching from very high-speed DSL, DSL that's 10 to 15 times faster here. They're switching over to fiber. How did they do it? Look, part of what did it was that they're more densely populated. We can't dismiss that. The last caller talked about a rural area. There's a data point called loop length, which is how long the wire is from the telephone to the average home. Our loop lengths are about 50% to 100% longer than loop lengths in most other countries, just because we're a more rural, dispersed, suburban country. But the other way they did it, frankly, was subsidies. The Japanese government said they set a national policy. They had the prime minister directly involved in this with the top CEOs of the country. And they said, we're going to be the world's leading broadband country. And they use tax incentives. They use low interest loans. They use other types of grants, as well as just persuasion and pressure to get the telephone companies to invest in fiber. And that's what Korea did as well. So we need to be thinking somewhat along those same lines.
Scott Walsh, go ahead, please.
Well, another point to make about Japan is actually they are lower in the OECD rankings than we are now. And again, it's because of the large household size. Because as a result of that, we're going to continue to decline just because you need fewer connections per household. Another just interesting point about Japan is that certainly NTT has the most fiber, but also electric utilities are providing fiber connections. And that's something we, for the most part, aren't seeing here. And I think, it comes back to questions perhaps of competition. What are barriers to entry in and for inter-platform competition, or whether it's, you know, just a bad business model.
Well, is there enough evidence to suggest that markets are failing to satisfy American demand for broadband? That seems to be what we're hearing from a few of our callers.
The evidence doesn't show any systematic market failure. And I think one of the problems when people say that there's a market failure and they say we need a national broadband policy, they tend to be very vague about what it should be. When we propose these policies that will be hugely expensive, and the reason there isn't broadband in rural Millwood is because it's very expensive to bring it there. And we could have a policy discussion on whether we think it's worthwhile for society to invest in a very expensive line. But It's hugely expensive, and we need to do careful analyses to see whether these programs are going to be effective. There are already a number of policies intended to promote broadband, and almost no research as to whether those policies are effective.
Well, of course, there's a market failure. Yeah, I mean, 75% of the calls that we've had already today say, I can't get broadband service, I can't get reliable broadband service. So yes, there's a market failure. And maybe the taxpayer does have to pay to ensure that everybody gets to participate in this economy. I mean, again, to repeat myself, is that broadband is crucial to so many things. It's crucial to saving energy, to allow people, so people can telecommute. It's crucial to creativity. It's crucial to economic empowerment. So I think this country, I agree with Rob, I think we need to look at whether there might be some subsidy. I mean, look, let's get back to Japan. First of all, I want to disagree with Rob. While this country is rural, 79% of Americans live in urban areas. So this country is not as rural as some would like you to think. But in Japan, for 65 cents on the dollar, you get broadband that's 20 times faster. I mean, why is that?
Well, Rob, we've heard some of the anecdotal evidence here from people who have difficulty getting broadband, but is there a way we can measure the demand for broadband in the U.S.?
Well, this one, I kind of agree with Scott, and I kind of agree with Gigi. I mean, I don't think there's a market failure for rural broadband. These companies are out looking to make a profit, and if they thought they could make a profit by putting broadband there, they would. And the issue is, as Scott rightly alludes to, the cost of putting it out there is probably more than what those people are willing to pay for. The market failure is essentially what economists would call a net externality or network effects. In other words, if everybody or more people are on broadband, the overall network works better. You can cut costs and all that. That's really the issue here, is that it's in individuals' incentive to invest in less broadband than it is in society. And that's why I go back to the point that Gigi made and I made, which is why that's incumbent upon society to say, we want more broadband than individuals or the market alone will get us right now. We want to get there faster and we want more of it.
We're going to have to take a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, depending on whether you want to get more broadband or whether you feel that the taxpayers should not be paying for this, you can call us at 800-433-8850. It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on broadband speed and access. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, how Washington spawned the angriest man in America, comedian Louis Black on politics, culture, and growing up in the D.C. area, plus a global perspective on spiking oil prices. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, right after the Kojo Nandi Show, it's Tell Me More with Michelle Martin.
Do you cry every time you pull up to a gas station and see $4 a gallon on the pump? Well, your friends in Norway are paying close to $10.
People realize that the gasoline tax has good purposes.
But don't dry those tears yet. In Venezuela, the price is less than 10 cents.
We are more wasteful than you are because we have the cheap gas.
I'm Michelle Martin, life in the two countries with the world's highest and lowest gas prices. Next time on Tell Me More.
And that's coming up at 2 o'clock here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Macro International, an applied social research company with 40 years' experience helping governments improve lives worldwide. More information is available at macrointernational.com. From the Association of American Railroads, today's freight railroads are committed to working hard for the environment by moving a ton of freight 436 miles on just 1 gallon of fuel. More online at freightrailworks.org.
It's 93 degrees in Northwest Washington as the Kojo Nandi Show continues at 1242.
Our guests for this Tech Tuesday discussion on broadband are Robert Atkinson, president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, Scott Walston, vice president for research and senior fellow at the Technology Policy Institute, and a senior fellow at the Georgetown Center for Business and Public Policy, and Gigi Sohn, president and founder of Public Knowledge. Let's immediately go to the telephone because I think Drew can take us where I'd certainly like for us to go. Drew, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. This is Drew Clark with BroadbandCensus.com, and we're a new website trying to map out the availability, competition, and speeds of broadband throughout the country. Your panelists have been talking about the availability of broadband, and there's been some disagreement about competition and how effective it will be in driving down prices. But what I want to ask your panelists about is whether they think it's important that consumers know which companies are out there that are providing or not providing broadband in their local areas.
You, Gigi?
Well, absolutely it's important, Drew. But it's important to know a number of things. It's important to know not only who has broadband and not just by zip code, as we talked about before. We need to know who's providing that broadband, at what speed, and at what price.
Well, even as we speak, policymakers at the federal and state levels are moving to get better data on where broadband is available in the U.S. and the speeds at which people are getting it. What do you make of those efforts, and what data do we in fact need in order to move forward? The FCC this past March voted to approve a broadband mapping plan that would break down broadband availability by speed around the country. What do you think of that?
I think getting more data is absolutely crucial, because if we're going to evaluate prospective policies, we need good data to do it. I think efforts like Drew's at BroadbandCensus.com to gather information from the ground up are really good ones. I'm not convinced that the mapping is the right solution. I really like the data gathering by the census, and I hope they continue to include broadband questions on their current population survey that they do every year. They stopped that in 2003, and they started again last October. And I think data like that are really useful. I think it's also important, if I might add too, that perhaps the FCC and the companies that provide data might rethink what they keep proprietary and what they make public, because the FCC doesn't have to release only the number of providers in a zip code. They actually know how many subscribers for each provider there are, and they don't release it because it's considered proprietary. And certainly some of the data the companies provide is legitimately proprietary and competitively sensitive, but perhaps they could rethink how much they release.
Gigi?
Well, I think the FCC has taken a really good step, because I don't think you can have broadband policy unless you know who has broadband. But what the FCC hasn't done is demand the price. It's not good enough to know just where you have it and the speed. You also need to know what people are paying for it. The other thing that I understand that the FCC has done, and one of the reasons why, even though the FCC announced this decision in March, we still haven't seen a decision, the actual text of the decision, and now it's June, is because they are putting both business and residential lines together. And several people, including FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, wants to see them separated out because they are very, very different.
Well, you think, I know, Rob, that mapping is a good thing, but how should we define broadband as we measure connection speeds in the United States?
Well, the current approach is 200 kilobits a second, which is, you know, anemically slow. I live in Bethesda, and I get 15 megabits, which is a significantly higher fiber optic right to my home. And we've proposed that you start at 2 megabits and you work your way up. And it ought to be, there ought to be a broadband inflation number each year. So each year the standard gets higher. But we could, the idea somehow that 200 kilobits is broadband. It was 10 years ago. It isn't now. And we need to recognize that.
And I know the public knowledge has pushed a broadband data reporting bill at the state level in Maryland, correct, Gigi?
Yes, we did. And it was basically opposed vigorously by the cable companies and the telephone companies.
It hasn't moved forward.
It has not moved forward. This is now the second session in a row that we've had it introduced by Herman Taylor. And basically there's been hearings each time, and anybody can speak at a hearing. And every single Bell company and cable company lobbyist was out there voicing their opinion against it. And I don't really understand why, unless they don't want to see people. They don't want people to see that their broadband penetration is not great and their speeds are not great and their prices are too high. I mean, why would you oppose this?
On to Michael in Suitland, Maryland. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Hi, Michael. Are you there? Go right ahead, please.
Thank you. My comment is in regard to something the telecom representative stated earlier about internet pricing and competition.
We don't have a telecom representative here.
Well, the guy who's basically defending them.
Which one?
You know who I mean.
Okay, well, go ahead and raise your question. We'll see who jumps to respond.
I see here on the Discover France website that I can get cable internet in France on a 12-month contract for €15 per month. At the current exchange rate, that's less than two-thirds of what I have to pay for my Comcast cable in Suitland, Maryland. And Comcast and Verizon are the only cable suppliers that service my area. Now, interestingly enough, when I attempted to get a land-based telephone line, I tried to find a different telephone provider than either Comcast or Verizon because I didn't agree with their spending millions of dollars to grant themselves immunity for violating FISA. I couldn't. There was quite literally no option but to pay money to companies which, in my opinion, committed a criminal offense. These two things are textbook examples of why we have anti-monopoly laws, which don't seem to be enforced. And there is one other thing.
Well, you are clearly, Michael, for increased competition.
Oh, yes, but there's more to it than that. I seem to remember a couple of years ago that telecom companies brought some intense lobbying pressure to bear against efforts by local governments to enhance competition by creating local-level internet provider companies. The companies that existed actually lobbied to squelch the creation of those government-created providers precisely because they didn't want competition. And this higher pricing that we have now is in part a consequence of their success in actively fighting government efforts to do that.
I suspect all of our panel wants to comment on that. We will start with you, Rob.
Well, Michael, I guess I'd ask you, how many electric wires do you have to your house right now? How many gas pipes? How many sewer pipes? How many garbage collectors? How many postal delivery you have? And the answer is you have one. And there's a reason you have one, because it makes no economic sense to have two. So whenever there was a debate about competition in electricity, it was never in the last mile. It was always in production or distribution. That's the key point we have to remember here with competition. To somehow say that this is a monopoly, I mean, one of the things in the U.S. is we have, with maybe the exception of Korea, the most robust intramodal competition. So we do have about a 50-50 marketplace. If you go to Germany, you're at about a 93-7 marketplace where you have 93% of it's all in one kind of provider. So I think this notion somehow that saying we need more competition, you're confusing telecom with cars or telecom with haircuts or any other service.
Very interesting, Gigi, because what Rob seems to be suggesting is that we should start to look at broadband from a regulatory standpoint anyway, kind of like a public utility, like water or electricity.
Well, it is a public utility. The problem is that the government has completely given up on regulating it. Okay, electricity is regulated. Water is regulated. All those things that Rob talks about is regulated. Over the last 8 years particularly, it's just been let the free market flourish, and this is what you've got. I mean, you've got major market failure. Now, what the caller was talking about, I believe, was the efforts by some of the bell companies and cable companies to kill municipal Wi-Fi and municipal broadband systems. Now we can.
And in Philadelphia, it would appear that it's been killed.
It's been killed for a different reason. Actually, if you scroll back a couple of years, the bell companies and the cable companies tried to kill the entire notion of having a municipal Wi-Fi system, and they failed in Philadelphia. They failed doing that. They actually got legislation passed saying no municipal broadband, but they carved out Philadelphia. But let me talk a little bit about what
happened. I want to talk about how technology has changed the English language. She just said, if you scroll back a couple of years. But please go ahead.
The reason that you're seeing failures among municipal Wi-Fi systems, and there are some successes, Glasgow, Kentucky, St. Cloud, Florida. I mean, these are not big places, all right? Rural North Carolina. But the reason that you're seeing the failures in some of the big cities is because the governments thought they could get something for nothing, and the public thought they can get something for nothing, and entered into these private-public partnerships. Well, Earthlink wanted to make money. And they weren't making money because people expected something for free. So they folded their tents. I want to quote my colleague and Columbia Law professor, Tim Wu, who's written a great Slate article about this. He says, real public infrastructure costs real public money. So members of the public, if you want this municipal broadband, if you want this muni Wi-Fi, you have to be prepared to pay for it at least with some tax.
Indeed, the Philadelphia deal fell apart because of a disagreement among the city, the nonprofit, and the group Wireless Philadelphia that, according to Earthlink, the carrier will shut down the network on June 12th. And offer its Wi-Fi subscribers discounts on other Earthlink services. But your turn, Scott.
Gigi makes an excellent point. These networks are expensive, and if people want their governments to provide it for them, I think the efforts to make it illegal for a government to provide such service are terrible. I think the municipally owned networks are also a bad idea. But if people want to vote to waste their money, they should be free to do so. But it comes back to, it does come back to competition. And I think it's important to ensure that companies have an incentive to invest in new infrastructure. And I don't believe it's a natural monopoly. I have three telecom wires to my house. I know I'm unusual in Tacoma Park. We have Comcast, RCN, and Verizon. But I believe with the right incentives, companies will invest in additional platforms, including wireless. Gigi said that wireless isn't a good competitor, and it's certainly an imperfect competitor. But if you compare where it is now to even just a couple of years ago, it's much better. And we want to ensure that there are incentives to invest. And one thing is that the government actually is standing in the way in not the most recent auction, but the auction before that, the AWS auction. Several companies who are not currently providing broadband service bought more spectrum, but can't use it because government agencies are still on it.
Well, there's another kind of wireless technology that I think Martin in Washington, D.C. can take us to. Martin, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I was wondering how viable WiMAX and other technologies such as that would be in increasing the availability of broadband.
WiMAX, of course, being a wireless technology geared for longer distances. Starting with you, Rob.
WiMAX is just now beginning to get rolled out in a serious way, and we'll have to see how the market takes it, but I think it will be a significant alternative, particularly in rural areas. What we're going to see in the U.S. is a wide array of different technologies that are going to be in different kinds of places depending upon market characteristics. And WiMAX, for a lot of these callers earlier in the show who are in Loudoun or exurban counties of the district of D.C., WiMAX is probably going to be a key solution for them.
Gigi.
Well, WiMAX has been sort of perpetually the next best thing for like the last 5 years. So it's definitely wait and see. I'll agree with Rob. I don't want to make any predictions. I do think it's interesting to see that Clearwire, which was supposed to be the big WiMAX provider, has now had to get financing from Comcast, Google, and a host of other large companies to make its system work. So I hope it works, but it's wait and see.
How about broadband over power line, which is another technology that's being discussed?
Well, this seems to always be the technology right around the corner. It has been for many years.
Next best thing.
Right. And I think it's just impossible to predict what technology will bring, which is another reason why governments provide this infrastructure at their own risk, because it's really hard to predict what's coming. In Japan, as I mentioned, power companies are providing broadband over fiber because broadband companies own lots of fiber already, but they don't generally do that here.
Allow me to go to Jamie in Silver Spring, Maryland. Jamie, you're on the air, but we're running out of time. Please make your question or comment brief.
Okay. I'll try to make them as quick as possible. One, to what extent is this discussion of people in rural areas needing to switch over to broadband kind of a false imperative? I wonder, because it seems like a lot of the people in these areas don't necessarily need that service, and it's kind of being put upon them to, you know, shoulder the burden for the rest of people that do need the service so the broadband can run faster. My other question deals with what would be a feasible way to implement a policy which would, you know, make broadband a government issue as opposed to a privately owned issue?
Gigi?
Well, I want to attack the notion that rural people don't need broadband service. They probably even need it more. I mean, I've seen anecdotes about farmers who check grain prices through their through their internet connections.
Now, people think that farmers mosey, so they probably only need dial-up. But go ahead, please.
No, I mean, that's absolutely not the case. And to the extent that rural folks are often sort of disconnected from the rest of the country, they need it even more for distance education and other things like that. So I absolutely reject that notion.
And this email, since we're running out of time, there was another question about government provision of broadband that Jamie had.
Yeah, I don't think that's the right answer. These are very complex networks. They're hard to build. They're hard to manage. I think the better model, if you look at what some of the leaders are doing, and Japan I would put as a leader, even though their penetration isn't as high, their speeds are enormously high, so I put them as a leader. Both Japan and Korea basically have adopted the public-private partnership model. They rely on private providers, but they give them incentives. They give them help. I think that's the right model here.
And an indication from Taragu's email in Laurel that digital literacy may be more than people need. Taragu writes, "My reason for not having high speed is because dealing with these companies is just a great big pain in the kazoo," to quote a former president. "I called 5 different providers. I spent nearly 30 minutes on the phone with Verizon, mostly on hold, talking to different people who gave me different stories and different prices. And finally, I gave up." There is a new kind of literacy that is needed to talk to the companies that are delivering these services. I'm afraid we're out of time. Gigi Sohn is president and founder of Public Knowledge. That's a Washington-based advocacy group dedicated to promoting the public interest and access to information. Robert Atkinson is president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. That's a think tank that studies public policies related to technological innovation. Scott Walson is vice president for research and senior fellow at the Technology Policy Institute, senior fellow at the Georgetown Center for Business and Public Policy. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, how a local community and a committed music director nurtured a band from the D.C. public schools to national fame, the story and music of Ballou Senior High's Marching Knights, plus cool, crisp wines for steamy summer nights, the season's wine tips. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon, I'm Matt McCleskey. The second hour of today's Kojo Namdi Show is coming up next.